But first, Roseanne Cash. Cash is the daughter of country music icon Johnny Cash, but she's followed her muse to forge her own very successful music career and emerge from the Man in Black's long shadow. Roseanne Cash has recorded 14 albums that have charted 11 number one singles. She's also written essays in fiction. Her latest literary work is a memoir called Composed. Cash spoke with Steve Paulson about this chronicle of her life.
Near the end of your memoir, you write, "For me, art is a more trustworthy expression of God than religion." Why is that the case for you?
Well, there's no dogma attached to art, number one. And I think that that source of creativity of art and music is really the deepest kind of spirituality to me. And wherever that source lies, to me, that is God, where love and art and music come from. You know, it's a dogma that has proven to be so destructive. That kind of religion, kind of squeezing it into a framework that's too small for it.
Are there times when you feel connected to some transcendent reality through your music?
Of course, absolutely. In performing, in writing, in standing in front of a Rembrandt. Even if you can't quite touch the transcendence, there's always the possibility.
Now, your sixth album, King's Record Shop, was released in 1987. It was very successful. You had four number one country singles from the album, the first woman in country music to do so. And it was while you were making this album, you say that you had a dream that changed your life.
Yeah, it did. Well, I should first say that you know, I knew Linda Ronstadt kind of. We were acquaintances for many years, and I always respected her greatly. And she said this great thing that I always remembered. She said, "Refine your skills so you can support your instincts." And I thought that was such a beautiful thing to say, and I didn't totally know what she meant until I had this dream. I dreamed I was at a party, and Linda was there. And there was an elderly gentleman by the name of Art. And they were sitting on a bench talking. And I sat on the other side of him and I tried to insert myself into the conversation. And he turned his back to me and I was devastated. And I said, why are you turning your back to me? And he said, "We don't respect dilettantes." Well, I woke up from the dream just shaken to the core. I mean, people might think, oh, well, this is, you know, just, it's not that important. This was everything to me, that Art had turned his back on me.
Did that dream sort of hit the nail on the head for you? I mean, did you?
Yes.
So you sort of had been a dilettante.
Well, on one level, I think I made good records up to that point, and I think I had a sense of artistry and development, but I was dabbling at this point. I was using the skills that I already knew I had and not pushing myself further, not in singing, not in writing, not in overview or some kind of vision. And I changed things that day. The day after that dream, I started painting. I started taking voice lessons. I started just pulling myself out of my dreamy state to focus on my work.
Why did you start painting?
I wanted to see what it felt like not to use language and to see if I could develop a finer instinct for language by not using it, by removing it from my creative life. And I did. It was amazing. And also I saw in painting that the same kind of process went on in my head that went on in performing and writing, you know, the criticism, the editing too soon rather than waiting till the end of the process. And it was very instructive and it kind of opened my mind up.
Through this whole process, after this dream, do you think you became a better songwriter?
I do. I know I did. In King's Record Shop, I only wrote three songs on that record. So it was almost as if I was in a tunnel of diminishing, you know, how much I was writing. It was growing less. And I think that's what the dream was partly warning about as well. So the next record, they were all my songs.
So what changed for you in the songs you yourself wrote?
Well, the next record, which was Interiors, it was very reflective, you know. I think I was more poppy before then. In interiors, I became much more reflective and darker. And, you know, I didn't have one number one single off that record. And in fact, the Nashville division dropped me after that record. And yet I was very happy with what I was doing.
I know there were some critics and fans who considered interiors a real breakthrough for you, maybe a cathartic experience.
It was a breakthrough for me.
Because it allowed you to, I don't know, get away from sort of more the pop side of music to go deeper into yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about making hit records. I was just thinking about the work itself, like what is good, you know, trying to hone my skills as a songwriter and letting it come from a place that was unguarded and without contrivance, you know. I even hung this sign over the door of the studio, the control room, when I was making interiors, and it said, "Abandon thought, all ye who enter here." A play on Dante's Abandon Hope. Hoping to get to something that was just directly from the creative source rather than contrived.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite song from Interiors?
There's this song that didn't really get much attention on Interiors. It's the closing song of the record. It's called Paralyzed. I don't write on piano that often, but it's one of the few that I've written on piano. I mean, it's not by any means a commercial type song or it doesn't have a hook or anything, but there's something that felt like a breakthrough to me of that song.
I picked up the phone. You were both on the line. Your words to each other froze me in time. A lifetime between us just burned on the wires. Dissolved in a dial tone, consumed in your fires.
Skipping ahead a little bit, you write that the title track from your 1993 album, The Wheel, is one of your fans' favorite songs. And in fact, if you don't sing that at a concert, people will start to get upset.
It's so true. If I skip it, I swear I get a note sent backstage. You didn't do the most important song in your repertoire.
Why do you think that song hits home so powerfully for so many people?
Oh, gosh. Maybe for the same reasons that it felt like it hit me when I was writing it. You know, I had this feeling of utter liberation and that things were going to turn out well for me, that I was falling in love. And, you know, it was just this great moment. It was interesting how I wrote that song. I don't even think I wrote about this in the book, but, you know, I had a lot of small children, and I was just going insane with one of those kid days where they're cranky and they need everything. And the babysitter came over. I said, "Look, I need 5 minutes to myself." And I went in the room, locked the door, and I started writing The Wheel immediately.
How long was I asleep? When did we plan to meet? Have you been waiting long for me? When did the sky turn black? Do you still want me back? I'll pick it all up piece by piece. And the wheel goes round and round. And the
You write very movingly about your parents who, when they passed away, and sort of the final times you spent with them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about the making of September When It Comes, the duet you sang with your father, Johnny Cash, when he was near the end of his life?
Yeah, he had been sick for a long time. And, you know, I was going back and forth to Nashville. He was in the hospital a lot. And there was this background anxiety in my family that he wasn't going to last much longer. It was just constant, you know. It's the kind of thing you wake up with, think about the first thing, go to bed with, think about the last thing. I was so worried about him. And in thinking about his mortality and how my life might change to lose my parent, I wrote September When It Comes. I wrote the lyrics and I left them around the house, and my husband, John, found them. He said, "What is this?" I said, "Oh, some song I'm writing." And he wrote the melody to it. So I recorded it by myself. And after we recorded it, John said to me, "You know, you should ask your dad to sing on this song with you." I said, "No, no, no." You know, I was just had this knee-jerk reaction from my whole career of never exploiting my dad, never using my dad, trying to do it on my own. So John brought it up three or four times, and finally he said, "If there was ever a time and ever a song, this is it. You really should ask your dad." And it hit me that he was right. And I called my dad, and I said, "I have this song I'd love for you to sing on, Dad." And he said, "Well, I'll have to read the lyrics first." So I said, "I'll bring them in person." And I went down and I showed him the lyrics, and he nodded. He knew totally that it was about his mortality. He said, "I can do this." And we recorded it that day. It was a very moving experience. Truthfully, I still can't bear to listen to the song. It may take me another decade.
When the shadows lengthen and burn away the past, they will fly me like an angel to a place where I can rest. When this begins,
I'll let you in
September
when it comes.
Now, you yourself have had some serious medical issues, and you had brain surgery in 2007. And you say that you always knew that at some point you would have to have brain surgery.
It's interesting, isn't it? When the neurologist told me I needed to have brain surgery, there was this sense of relief and like a puzzle falling into place for me. So it's not that I knew, like I thought, oh, someday I will have it. It's that it felt familiar when he said that. And I was relieved, you know. I'd had crushing headaches for years, and I was happy someone finally knew what was wrong with me.
So what was the diagnosis?
It's actually a rare condition. It's called Chiari 1. And, you know, the simple explanation is that if your cerebellum is supposed to be in Vancouver, mine had been crushed down to Houston.
So it was crushing your brainstem? Was that it?
It was crushing my brainstem. So I was not only having headaches, I was having brainstem symptoms too, which are kind of scary, you know, because it's breathing and swallowing and those things that kind of keep you alive. So they rearranged the map of my brain.
So the surgery obviously was successful.
Yeah, it was.
Did it change you in some way other than just, you know, relieving the pain?
It changed me fundamentally, Steve. You know, it's a cliche. People say you get a mortality scare and your life changes. It's absolutely true. Although I don't think it changes everyone in the same way. But I certainly feel an urgency about the work I want to complete in this world. And I feel a sense of joy that I didn't feel before. And physiologically, it changed things. You know, I perceive music in a different way. It's subtle, and maybe I'm the only one who could tell, but it's very different to me. There's greater expansion in my understanding of music, which is fantastic.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, we've been talking to some degree about the legacy that you grew up with. I mean, you know, having Johnny Cash as a father and, you know, becoming a musician after that. I mean, boy, what a shadow to work under.
Yeah.
And your most recent album is called The List, inspired by a list of 100 essential songs that your father gave you when you were 18, apparently to try to increase your knowledge of country music. It sounds like maybe you felt like it was time to deal with his legacy in some way.
Yes. I mean, that's also, I think, partly a result of the brain surgery. I started thinking about what I wanted to leave to my children and my own bucket list, no pun intended. And on that list of the things I most wanted to complete were finishing my memoir and making this record The List. And there was that feeling of, if I don't step into this legacy, my daughter, who's a musician, won't be able to. That this is part of my family, and it's not gracious to push it away any longer. And that I'm ready to bring my sensibilities as a songwriter, as a New Yorker, as someone who's been a performer for 30-something years to these songs. You know, these songs I don't think a young person really could have done. I think you had to bring a full life to them.
Mm-hmm. Of course, your dad, Johnny Cash, was not around by the time you recorded The List. What do you think he would have made of your album?
Oh, it's just so bittersweet to me, because it's one of those paradoxes that I don't think I could have recorded it while he was still alive, and yet it breaks my heart that he can't hear it. I think he would have been incredibly excited. In fact, when I was in the studio recording Long Black Veil, I stopped mid-vocal take and said to John, if Dad could hear me singing Long Black Veil, he would just fall over. He just wouldn't believe it. He would be so thrilled.
She walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows.
That's Roseanne Cash with Long Black Veil from her latest album, The List. Cash is the author of Composed, a memoir. She spoke with Steve Paulson.